And this is KPCW. KPCW News Time is 8:06. Let's see what we got coming up for our weather this weekend. Here's a report from Cedric Haynes.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for a look at your forecast for the Wasatch. Back on this Friday, we're looking at lots of sunshine. Temperatures climbing into the upper 50s in Park City this afternoon. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid-60s in the Heber Valley with lots of sunshine. Now, as we go into tonight, into to early Saturday morning, we'll see a few clouds on the increase. We'll call it partly cloudy for your Saturday. You'll notice the winds beginning to pick up out of the south and southwest as we go throughout the day as well. Temperatures will start off in the 30s during your Saturday morning, but we'll see a nice rebound with those partly cloudy skies during the day Saturday. Highs should climb into the low 60s in Park City as we get towards your Saturday afternoon, with highs in the mid to upper 60s for the Heber Valley. Now, as we move into your Sunday, Saturday night really, into Sunday, we've got a cold front that's going to be moving across far northern Utah. That cold front's going to bring in some colder air. We'll see our temperatures dipping back down into the 30s as we go towards your Sunday morning, but they're not going to rebound much during the day on Sunday. In fact, high temperatures will likely be in the 40s and 50s, but then we'll start to drop as we go into the second half of the day. That means any rain showers will likely change over to snow showers as we go throughout the day on Sunday, starting around Park City and eventually making its way as far south as the Heber Valley by Sunday night. We'll still see some lingering moisture into your Monday morning, so that means Sunday night into Monday morning, another round of possibly rain and snow will be making its way through portions of the Wasatch Back, including both Park City and the Heber Valley, as temperatures dip down below freezing. High temperatures as we go into your Monday, only around 40 degrees for us in Park City, so you'll need those winter coats, with highs climbing only into the upper 40s in the Heber Valley. We'll start to rebound things, though, as we go into your Tuesday, as high pressure rebuilds across the area. We bring back the sunshine. Temperatures starting off in the mid-20s on your Tuesday morning. High temperatures, though, should be in the upper 40s in Park City, with highs in the mid-50s in the Heber Valley. And we're back to the mid-50s for highs in Park City for the middle of next week, along with highs in the low 60s for the Heber Valley with lots of sunshine. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, the North Summit School District is asking locals to vote for a $121 million bond this November. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the bond will fund the construction of a new high school and swimming pool.
The North Summit School District Board of Education, Superintendent, and Business Administrator are urging residents to vote yes on a general obligation bond on November 4th. They say the bond is needed to replace the aging North Summit High School and its swimming pool. The $121 million bond would be paid over 20 years through property taxes. The average homeowner in the district with a $722,000 property would pay $887 over that time period. A business of the same value would pay $1,600. That's about $40 per year for a homeowner and about $80 per year for a business. According to a voter pamphlet, the high school opened in the fall of 1977 and has many failing systems. In a letter to parents, the board, Superintendent Wade Murdoch, and Business Administrator Marcy Sargent said the high school's infrastructure is, quote, increasingly inadequate for safety and security. A new high school would feature modern safety standards, including secure entry points, emergency response systems, and accessibility features. District leadership said the new high school would be more sustainable and reduce long-term operational costs and environmental impact. It would also accommodate growth in the district. The pool is also outdated. While it's been well-maintained since its construction in 1966, it's outlived the lifespan of an aluminum pool. It's also not regulation size for high school standards. District leadership says a new high school and pool are a practical solution and necessary to ensure students continue getting a quality education. This is not the first time a bond for a new high school has been put before voters. In 2024, 56% of voters rejected a similar bond. The district said previously its only options are to approve the bond through the election process this year or fund the project through lease revenue bonds. To do that, the school board would create a local building authority to issue the bonds. LRBs don't require voter approval and are essentially the district going into debt. The district then pays the building authority back with money from property taxes as well. It's the same tool the Wasatch County School District used to fund its new high school in 2022 after its bond failed in 2019. If voters approve North Summit's bond, construction on a new high school will start in the spring of 2026. It would be built on district-owned property southwest of the Colville Cemetery. The new high school could serve 640 students with opportunities for expansion to meet future needs. The property also has room for athletics facilities, including a gym, auditorium, football stadium with an 8-lane track, practice field, baseball and softball diamonds, and outdoor courts. Once the new high school is completed, the old one will be torn down and the new pool will be built in its place. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
October is Spine Health Awareness Month. The state of the art in spine care, and in spinal surgery in particular, is rapidly evolving. Here to give us a sense of what is happening is Dr. Scott Adelman of the Smart Clinic. Have I got that right, Scott?
Yes, you did.
Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for actually asking me to come spend time with you.
So, Scott, look, back problems are so common. Why does this part of the human anatomy so often fail with those painful symptoms?
Well, most of us have had either personal experience with back pain, or we have family members that have had serious experiences with back pain. And, you know, from a population standpoint, there are several categories that put us at risk for spine pain. There's trauma, accidents, your work environment, your habits, your lifestyle, and even genetics. But the number one cause for back pain is actually just aging, getting older.
And is that, why does it happen? I mean, this part of the anatomy obviously tends to be far more subject to sort of pain than others. Is it because we walk upright? I mean, what is the evolutionary aspect of this thing?
Well, you're touching on a great conversation on epidemiology, which I'm not qualified to actually dive into, but we're all aware of the stories about humans really weren't made to walk upright like this. And that actually combines itself with the aspect of aging, and it's just a matter of time. The average adult, 1 in 3 of us will have back pain, 1 episode every 3 months or so. And by the time you get to adulthood, about 85% of us will actually have significant aspects of back pain to manage.
And let's talk about, how is that pain managed? What is the traditional approach to the management of spine pain in general and degenerative disc disease in particular?
Well, one of the challenges today is to talk about generalities and population issues, but also dive into really small, specific nuances. So from a population standpoint, just simple things. You've heard it, 6 weeks of therapy. When you hurt your back, first thing you do is 6 weeks of therapy. Well, that's a population recommendation, but as an individual, there are many examples of where that's not appropriate. Next is relative rest, and then over-the-counter medications, and then escalate medications as appropriate, not getting into what we now recognize is a problem with opioids. That's another show. However, that's the basics. My area of expertise is a little bit beyond the average patient who gets better with those simple approaches to population aspects. You know, I deal with very intricate spine aspects, targeting problems, and trying to provide, you know, elegant management of those issues.
So the sort of regime you just talked about is sort of what traditionally happens when somebody first manifests with back pain. You try, and I guess it makes sense, you try the most conservative approach first, which is the physical therapy and the over-the-counter drugs. But, you know, for so many people, the spine, and let's talk about degenerative disc disease, is that the most common sort of presentation that you see with respect to people who can't, you know, be helped by those more conservative techniques first?
Well, another great question, again, to try to point out some definitions. Mm-hmm. Back pain is a symptom.
Right.
Back pain is the number one cause of lost productivity in the United States. It's the most expensive, it's the most prevalent problem in work environment as well as life and activities of daily living. But degenerative disc disease is an image diagnosis. In other words, you need to have an MRI, you need to look at the pathology, and that is, in the history of back pain, it is almost, not 100%, but it's degenerative disc that is the predisposing initial problem that leads to.
So let's take a step back and look at the spine from behind it. What are discs, you know, and why do they degenerate?
That's another phenomenal question. I'm having a lot of fun with you. You have a great inquisitive mind. So the spine is actually, people have seen the skeletons and mm-hmm. Halloween's on the way. So it's a stack of bones with jelly donuts between each of those bones, and the donuts are the discs, and the vertebrae are the struts and structures, and that's how you stack up and create a spine. The smaller details are in the posterior spine, the facet joints and muscles and ligaments, et cetera, that stabilize that and allow for flexibility, rotation, and all of those motions. So as we age, the inciting and insulting event typically is an injured disc. It can be very subtle, and everybody's will progress at a different rate, but degenerative disc disease is the target.
And when that happens, I'm visualizing these bones or vertebrae, I guess they're called, the sort of cushion that goes between them starts to deteriorate. Do they get closer together? Do they run into nerves? What's causing that pain?
Yes. So the cascade is the donut starts to leak. And I always use the analogy of the jelly donuts we ate as kids. You'd eat two or three, and then the fourth one, when you were stuffed, you just kind of pushed and squished it and watched the jelly come out. And then you left it on the counter till the next day. Well, when you came to look at it the next day, that jelly went from real soft and jelly to hard as a rock. So that would be a leaky disc. That's a disc that actually has a defect, and it progresses from just a little defect to then leaking out chemicals in the nucleus of the disc. A disc itself with a simple injury can hurt, but when it starts to leak, that can hurt. And then when it progresses, it can herniate and physically start to push on things. So those are the aspects of a degenerative disc that lead to a disruptive disc, that lead to a herniated disc, etc.
And we've heard those terms like slip disc and herniated disc. Those just mean that donut has started to fail in one way or another, basically?
Yes, it's a layman's terms on how to sort of educate patients on your disc is the problem.
Okay. And traditionally, going back 20, 30 years, what was if you couldn't, again, go through those more conservative steps and you needed some kind of surgical intervention, what would be done?
Well, if you look at degenerative disc disease as just a population aspect, the conversation still focuses on what do you do with a dark disc?
Right.
In the medical arena, when you go to meetings, it's always part of the conversations and the overlapping opinions. What do you do with a dark disc? Historically, and we talked about population management in general, stay conservative as long as you can. The other aspect used to be, and I say used to because it's not part of my recommendation anymore, is live with it as long as you can, and then when you can't take it anymore, come see me. And that's when it would lead to extreme examples of care, which we've all heard of fusions and how everybody has an example in their family, or hopefully not personally, of a problem where the fusion wasn't the result they expected. And fusions have been studied for decades, and we know that they do not have a phenomenal track rate. They're definitely required in appropriate circumstances. You can't eliminate that procedure. It's too valuable. But as far as population in general, sweeping across the population that have failed management for back pain and just jumping to fusion has been our problem.
So let's go back to explain what fusion is. I'm visualizing, again, the skeleton that we're going to see hanging over Main Street for Halloween. There's all those little vertebrae. We've got the jelly donuts in between. Obviously, the advantage of that structure is it allows flexibility, movement, everything can move. What happens when you fuse vertebrae?
Well, overly simplistic, but
yes.
The history was a posterior approach, and I guess I try to always use simple analogies, but if you've ever gone to the beach and played on the beach with your family, and it's a nice, dry, sandy day, and you give them some shovels and they start digging, you notice that the deeper they go, the wider the hole gets. And it's not a small process to dig that sand, dig that hole in the soft sand. Same with the spine. They used to open the spine, retract it, make sure that everything is accessible, that was the key, controllable, and do a deeper operation where they remove disc, remove problems that have caused nerve pinching or instability, and then you have to put screws in each bone, and then you have to put a rod between those two bones. And that is a construct that prevents further degeneration, motion, and has been presented as solve that problem. That level won't be a problem again.
Okay, and what happens then, obviously you must lose some flexibility because your back is, because that joint won't move anymore.
True,
okay.
True, and then the next conversation becomes, what does that do to the spine and the motion at adjacent segments?
Right, that was my next question.
And that is another very worthy topic, talking about adjacent segment disease and how we manage that in the past, and that's transition to current options.
And we sort of touched on this a little bit, but one of the articles you sent me talked about something called failed back syndrome. And that is you hear stories about traditional back surgeries, and what you hear is not something that sounds remarkably consistently successful.
Correct.
So what is failed back syndrome, and how prevalent is it or has it been historically?
Rather prevalent, can be in different studies as little as 10 and 15% of patients, but you can see articles that are rather extreme where up to almost nearly half of the patients suffer from some element of failed back syndrome. But it does go back to your earliest conversation here and questions on what is the problem. And a dark disc, as a degenerative disc, was frequently operated on and fused. And there are some famous research papers that showed if you did a disc study and you tried to prove that disc hurt, and then you took them to fusion, that failed. And it wasn't so much that the fusion fails itself, mm-hmm. It's the targeting that fails. It's not a clear diagnosis or a clear pathology that should have been considered for fusion, in my opinion. And that's also changing with research currently. But the fusion itself, if it doesn't help, there is a significant patient population that will be left with chronic pain. And syndrome, failed back syndrome, is a cluster of symptoms, but it, overly simplistic here, mm-hmm. It requires a surgery. So you're trying to operate on a patient with back pain. You fuse them, and it fails. And they're still in serious pain. What do you do next? And that's an area of expertise all by itself.
And what happens, I take it, is you go back and try something else. It's a revision of some kind, right?
Yes. The simple answer is sometimes you get a revision. Sometimes you get another adjacent segment that's fused again. Sometimes you end up with all kinds of interventions with pain therapies and neuromodulation therapies and medication management problems. And you see where that's going.
So it's interesting. We've been talking about degenerative disc disease. And what we're talking about is sort of, to be really simplistic about it, working around the problem rather than trying to fix the disc. Why haven't we been able to fix discs? I mean, it seems to me that would be more straightforward.
Well, that's an unbelievable segue into what's currently inspiring my work. And it's now really becoming rather rapidly apparent that disc replacement, dealing with the primary natural history fundamental problem, if caught at right timing, that is the way to go.
Okay, what is disc replacement?
Well, with our current constructs and the way a disc replacement is applied today, essentially the first disc replacements were pursued in the very late 80s, 1989, right into the early 90s. And they were done in Germany. And I may not get this right, but the hospital, I believe, was named Charité. It wasn't the person who created it. But the Charité disc was implanted in Europe in the late 90s, or early 90s, late 89, early 90s, and showed some very promising results. And that evolved and then spread around the world, and it's gone through ups and downs. We've had challenges with outcomes. We slowed the American adaptation down dramatically because too many people started doing Charité too fast and had so many adverse issues that our system looked at that, our country looked at that, and said, hold on, we're going to stop this for a little while.
Okay, so what was the artificial disc made of, and how was that sort of surgical process different than what we've been talking about, which is just attacking the vertebrae?
So disc replacement, obviously you have to approach the disc from an angle that is safe. You're not trying to create more problems by eliminating important structures. You're trying to get to it safely. And that was the advent of an anterior approach, going through the abdomen, having someone, a good access surgeon, make sure that the abdomen is well protected, vessels are identified, and then the surgeon's gonna actually spend time putting in an artificial disc. You gotta remove the bad one, make sure you decompress the nerves that are being compressed, and prep that segment to receive a new disc. That's how the initial approach was employed.
Yeah, you know, I'm visualizing somebody going through my stomach to get to my back, and that looks like it's a long way, and there's lots of good stuff between the front and the back that you really have to be careful with, I take it.
Yes, yes, all the above. And that team, in my experience and my referrals, that team is important, so we choose them wisely. But actually, the approach is really well tolerated. I speak from personal experience, you'll get to.
Okay.
But I also, my patients do really well with that approach. And you're actually recovering faster from an abdominal approach than you are from a disruption or a major disruption from a posterior approach. The structures posteriorly are just, so they remain painful so much longer.
Okay, so I've gone in there. What's the replacement disc made of? And how has it evolved since those first, what are they called, Charte procedures were brought to this country?
Yeah, Charte was the name of the disc, and great question. They're essentially a combination of metal and polymers or plastic. People have tried to come up with different types of metals, you know, titanium, molybdenum, ceramics. Most of them today are leaning towards one company's product, and of course I'll refrain from actually endorsing any individuals, but we've settled in on a pretty good system right now, and it's evolving yet again, going through another wave of evolution and new products coming out. But the systems that are employed right now at the highest level and most frequent are metal and high-density plastic polymer.
And how widely accepted is the sort of new disc replacement technology, and both by the medical community and, more importantly, by the people who pay for it, the various reinsurers and the various federal health care programs?
Well, we always in this country have relied on really good research and trying to provide great studies that prove something safe before we employ them. The challenge in spine is it's very expensive to document a particular specific study that will answer a question and then provide the ability to adapt that technology and technique across the population that were patients that weren't included in the original study. And that external bias, as we talk about, I hate to get into too many technical terms, but essentially using that has been challenging in America. We have very little access for disc replacements right now. They're just starting to get moving again. But the patients that benefit most don't fall within a criteria that the insurance company is willing to cover.
So I guess we're ways away from where this would be the sort of standard of care for degenerative disc disease.
It's so early on the front end. It's actually, it's an inspiration for my work in one aspect, but it's frustrating because it's not accessible.
And as you mentioned, you have been your own guinea pig with respect to this. What was your surgery like, and how has it impacted your ability to do the things you want to do?
Well, my journey was kind of influenced and certainly inspired by a journey from potato farming all the way to med school, all the way to spine care. But I'll divulge, I hurt my back very early in medical school, and it was recommended that I have a surgery. And I kind of studied a lot, and I knew better, and I refused that surgery. And it drove me into an area of medicine that was outside surgery, which is what I thought I would do initially, into more conservative care, rehab, physical medicine. And I actually followed this problem in my own spine since age 25, and I never had a back surgery until I was 63. And all along that journey, I kept paying attention to spine, spine care, spine diagnostics, excellent management. And I got to the point where I couldn't wait any longer. I lived an athletic life, and I couldn't do any of the lifestyle things that we enjoy here in Park City. And I actually did the research and found somebody that I allowed to do my lumbar disc replacement surgery, three levels, all at once. And that was one of the stories that came out. And since then, I've been advising a lot of our Park City folks and helping them advocate for the best care for themselves. And we now have a list of several people locally that both people would know that have done amazingly well with disc replacement surgery.
Dr. Scott Adelman, anything else we should touch on before we go? How can people learn more about this?
Well, a couple of things. This is Spine Health Month, and I don't mind pushing spinehealth.org, which is a billboard-type company that just promotes education on spine options. That's a great place to start. And I actually, in my current level of practice and career, I pretty much spend almost as much time advocating as I do working and training at this point. So you're welcome to get a hold of me at thesmartclinic.com, and the office number is 801-676-7627.
Dr. Scott Adelman, thanks so much for spending time with us. Well, the Park City Council held a regular meeting last night. Here with a debrief, I have Council Member Bill Sirocco. I should also point out that Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Morning, Bill.
Good morning, Roger. I was just listening to your last segment, and my back is aching a little bit.
I'll show a little spine, Bill.
There you go.
Okay. Five-acre parcel has been, it came up a couple times this week. I think Monday there was a session. What was that?
We had two open houses on Monday, one midday and one later in the afternoon, early evening.
Let's start with those. Were you either of those?
I was at both of those, okay. actually.
And tell us a little bit about what you gleaned from the community's reaction to the current sort of plans.
Yeah, we had pretty decent attendance, and actually the midday session was even better attended than the evening session or early evening session. And we got a lot of feedback. I mean, as you can imagine, this is Park City, so as I've explained it to a few people, the range of opinion was from like 0 to 100, mm-hmm. right? We're in the middle on this project, so we did get a lot of good feedback from the community, and we passed that feedback along to the consultants, the development team, and they were there for the event as well. And I think we had a public comment last night that thanked them for their ability to listen and take that feedback. So it was very helpful on Monday, and the project has evolved as a result of just that the two open houses on Monday.
Okay, so help people understand, where are we in this process? For the last year and a half, every time I talk to the mayor, I go, so when am I going to see a shovel? And obviously, we're not there yet, but things are moving.
Things are moving, Roger. We are currently in what's called an exclusive negotiating agreement, an ENA, with the Brinshore Development Group. They are the development partner that's leading the development side of this, and we are negotiating in good faith with Brinshore to come up with a project that meets the goals of the city council. And those goals of the city council are what we've defined from the public feedback and the public input, not just in the last week, but over years, Roger.
And you know, there have been, when those first drawings came out, there was concern that it looked like what I would call a Soviet bloc apartment complex. But at some level, there are mathematical constraints, which if you're going to have a certain amount of density, you're going to have a certain amount of mass. And how is that decision, deciding how to balance open space, park-like, inviting space versus raw numbers of units? How is that process of balancing those tough, tough considerations, how is that process working? If I got it right, by
the way. Yeah, you have, and right, like everything is a balance. So, I mean, everything in life is a balance. So, council's worked really hard, and I would say, council, nearly a majority of us, when we first saw the initial sort of plan, no one was a fan of the buildings that were represented there. Now, the issue is that that was not architecture. That was placeholders. We're trying to figure out what the site plan, what the footprints of the building should be on the property. The architecture and the design comes after that. So we haven't even started that portion of the process. So even if you see an image of a finished building in any of the work that we're working on, that is not the architecture yet. So I just want to be very careful about that. But look, the clearest way I can describe it to people is, the Engine House project, which is in the same area, that's 123 units on 1.8 acres. That is almost exactly one-third the size, the amount of land that we have at the 5.8. It's 5.4 acres, right? 1.8 times 3 gets you 5.4. One-third the land has 123 units, and the range of units that we were talking about last night was 106 to 112 on 3 times the amount of land. So we will have a considerable amount. I think we have close to about 1.7 acres of free open space on the parcel, just in the center of the parcel, and that's not including the setback areas.
Okay, so yeah, that does feel like it would be certainly less mass. When are there representations now? Were there representations at the open house that can give people a sense of what that would look like with open space?
Yeah, so one of the benchmarks they used is, I'll make sure I get this right, is Library Field. I don't want to call it a dog park. One of my colleagues would get upset at that. But Library Field is, I believe, 1.6 acres. Mm-hmm. So that's the comparable that they were using for the open space on the 5.5 acre project.
Okay, so process, where do we go from here, and what's the timeline look like?
So we last night at council, we were, being pushed by the development team. I don't want to say pushed. We were asked by the development team to, give them the green light to start spending additional funds on the project. So that means like a traffic study, which is critically important. We want to make sure we don't screw up anything over there, right? But in order to get there, the developer wanted to make sure the council was, you know, a thumbs up on where the project was. It was hard for us to give that thumbs up last night because we haven't seen the economics yet. We have some idea of what the changes the council has asked for in response to the public feedback to make the project better, but we want to see what the full sort of development capital stack looks like in the economics before we say yes, go ahead and spend, you know, another $50,000-$100,000 doing work.
Now, has the contemplated contribution by the city changed from the original the $30 million number that I think I remember?
Yeah, changed is probably not the right word. We always anticipated that, you know, in order to make it something that the people wanted, there would be some sort of, you know, additional investment. You know, we've made changes to the massing. Originally, in the RFP response, you know, people were taken aback at what they saw. I was too. I think everyone on council was. You know, we've dramatically changed the layout of the project since then, and we've broken the buildings up into smaller units, and we've really tried to listen to the public feedback. And I think, you know, we're looking to have another. This is on the agenda for November 6th. We have asked the development team to get us the economics by Friday, October 31st. So we have them ahead of the weekend before that next
and
council
hopefully
meeting.
They won't be too scary.
Yeah,
on Halloween.
Exactly. We're hoping that they won't be too scary. We're asking for treats, not tricks.
Okay. So anyway, so you'll have those on October 31st. You'll talk about them at the council meeting the following week.
Correct. And now it is a tight turnaround, so there is
a
potential.
There's an election in the middle of that to create some more.
Yeah, that just made it so much easier to have the conversation about this project.
Right.
It's a tight turnaround for the development team. Yeah. They may slip to the Monday before that Thursday council meeting. But we want to make sure that we get that information published. The public has access to it. The public can show up at the meeting and share their concerns or what they like, tell us what they like, or you know, hopefully tell us what a great job we've done. But yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right, so that's the next step, and will there be public comment at that November meeting?
There should be. If it's on the agenda and we do discuss it, there will be public comment.
And I suspect you'll get some.
Well, Roger, that's interesting, because last night
there was nobody there, right?
There was nobody
very,
there.
Very quiet. Yeah.
And we had one comment online, which was very insightful, mm-hmm. From an online listener. But there was no one else in the room.
Okay. I want to touch on Clark Ranch. There was a planning commission meeting on that this week. But based on the press reports, was not there. There was some cynicism, at least expressed by some members of the planning commission. Where are we in that? First of all, where are we in that process?
So where we are in the Clark Ranch process is, Roger, we currently have, there's an open planning application before the Planning Commission for the Clark Ranch project. As you may or may not know, council is pretty strictly prohibited from commenting publicly in writing, an email, or verbally on an ongoing application before planning. We want to make sure, Planning Commission is a separate body, so we need to make sure that they do their job, you know, without any interference from council. So I want to respect that. What I can say is that it's at the Planning Commission. It would need to get approved by the Planning Commission, and then there still would need to be a council approval on the economics and all that stuff that would come after that process.
Now, at one point, I believe that you and some others thought that it might be better to do a development on the other side of 40. At this point, I take it what's happening. I take it that won't come up again unless and until something happens with the planning process that would stop it from going forward. Is that overly simplistic on my part?
It may be, and I don't want to speculate, Roger. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a public meeting and we took a public vote, and I stand by my vote. I stand by, you know, the reasons for that vote, and we'll just take it as it comes. We'll see what happens at the Planning Commission.
It is an interesting question as to what would happen if the Planning Commission turned it down.
Yeah.
I guess then we'd be back at square one, effectively.
And look, one of the most difficult things in our job is balancing the need for workforce housing in our community versus, you know, making sure that we don't, you know, we don't create bigger problems with traffic. We don't put people in bad living situations, that we, you know, we take care of the workforce that we need to keep Park City the special place that it is, because we are a tourism town. We are a ski town. I would love us to be the best ski town in North America. And, you know, I will continue to work towards that and implement policies that support that.
Before we go, Bill, I want to talk about the sort of hiring of a new city manager, and not so much about the specifics, but about the process, about best practices. For the retention of somebody, that's obviously a critically important role. And indeed, it is by definition, the most important employee in the city's payroll. Talk to us a little bit about how you think the process is going and how you think it should go. What are the best practices for doing something like this?
Yeah, Roger, that's an interesting question because in some respects, you know, Park City is a small town, right? 8,500 residents, but we're really not. We're a much bigger organization. Our enterprise is much, much bigger. Our operating budget is approaching $100 million. So we're almost like a small corporation. You know, the city manager role, as you noted, is critically important. When we got the news of that Matt Dias was going to step down to take an amazing job in the private sector, and, you know, kudos to Matt. Matt did an excellent job for the city. It is a loss, but, you know, I knew within the first month of me starting at the city and interacting with Matt that there was a bigger future for him somewhere down the line. So when we got the news that Matt resigned, the first thing I did was reach out to our HR director, Sarah Mangano, and said, hey, we're going to hire a search firm to do this search, right? Because this is going to be a difficult role to fill. And she said, absolutely. So we've retained a search firm who specializes in recruiting city managers.
Talk about a specialized headhunter.
Yeah.
That's a niche within a niche.
Correct. And I know a little bit about that business because my wife is a partner at Spencer Stewart, which is a big global executive search firm. You know, her specialty is healthcare. But there are smaller boutique firms that specialize in city manager recruitment, nonprofit recruitment. So we've hired one of the best firms, and a firm who has a long amount of experience hiring city managers for places like Telluride and Steamboat and other mountain towns in the West. So what the firm does is they come in, they interview critical people in City Hall, city council members, the mayor, heads of different departments, and they build a role spec. And then they take that role spec, they go to their database, they go to their knowledge of you know, who is working in you know, similar situations, and they try to find the person who has the right qualities for the job, and then they try to entice them to leave where they are and to come to Park City.
They poach.
Yeah. Now, normally it wouldn't be hard to entice someone to come to Park City, except you're looking to get someone who might be working and living in Aspen or Telluride or Crested Butte or Sun Valley or Jackson, right? So, yeah, it's okay. Competitive.
And so that process obviously will be taken up in earnest once we have a new mayor.
Correct. You know, I think the role spec, they probably should have finished soon. They'll do their work and build a slate of candidates. I'm hopeful that what slate of candidates will be ready for us to interview, you know, the mayor, council, deputy city managers by, you know, sometime in mid-January, late January. I don't want to pin them down because they haven't given us timing yet, but that would be my expectation.
Okay, Bill, anything else we need to touch on before we go?
No, get outside, enjoy this beautiful day. I think we're going to get some snow on Sunday, and I'm hoping that we hear the snow guns fire up at both our partner resorts, Park City Mountain and Deer Valley, and I'm looking forward to a great ski season this year.
Absolutely. Okay, thanks, Bill. The saga surrounding congressional redistricting in Utah continues to evolve. Here with an update on what are a lot of developments is Elizabeth Rasmussen of Better Boundaries. Good morning, Elizabeth. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, a lot is going on here. First of all, in the lawsuit filed by the League of Women Voters, I understand that Judge Gibson has been holding a hearing to look at maps submitted by both the plaintiffs and the legislatures. What can you tell us about where that process stands?
So right now, we're currently actually in a hearing to hear the legislature's response to what the plaintiffs have said for this map. There are three maps that the court is considering right now. One is the legislature's map. It's map C that they submitted to the court during the special session. And then the plaintiffs have two maps as well that they bring the court for consideration. And after these hearings, the judge has until November 10th to choose which map will be in place for Utah.
And these hearings are, based on what I understand, is basically a series of experts are talking about the way in which each of the maps affects the population distributions for the voters in each district. Is that basically right?
Yes, correct. They're talking a lot about the map's fairness.
Okay. And one of the things that has come up was that the legislature passed a bill introduced by, I believe it was Senator Bramer, that mandated specific tests that were to be used to evaluate redistricting plans. Now, we can talk about what those tests were in a minute, but at the moment, are those tests the ones that are going to be applied by Judge Gibson, or do we know?
We don't know at this point. The plaintiffs in the case, they filed a challenge to Senator Bramer's bill, saying that it undermined the intent of Prop 4 and didn't follow this Prop 4 standards and requirements.
Can you help our listeners understand a little bit about how those tests work and what, you know, what the objection to using them is?
Yes, definitely. So there were three tests that were in this bill. There's the partisan bias test and the ensemble analysis, as well as the mean median difference. And before, it was just the partisan bias test, so they expanded it to two more. The issue with some of these tests are, especially with partisan bias, it's not meant for a state like Utah. It assumes a 50-50 split in a state, so it's generally used in states that have more of that even distribution between the two parties. Utah doesn't. And so the test is definitely misapplied here and makes it so a gerrymander can pass the test, when in reality, that map's not fair. Similar thing with mean median difference isn't great in a state with as few districts as we have. Ensemble is better, but the Proposition 4 stated clearly that you need to use multiple tests and the best available data. And the legislature instead decided to narrow it on some of the worst tests so that they could pass a map that favors a party.
Okay, so that legislation was passed and was signed. I take it the plaintiffs have said that is inconsistent with the requirements of Prop 4. So I take it that the judge is going to have to decide whether that statute, is it a constitutional question, whether that statute is applicable here, or is it a conflict with Prop 4? I'm struggling with law school exam questions here.
Yeah, it's getting pretty complicated. I mean, there's the constitutional question that the court has decided that we have the right to alter and reform our government through ballot initiative, and that was applied to Prop 4, so this is a statute, and it's in place. And so the real question is this bill that was passed by the legislature in line with Proposition 4?
And again, the previous decision by the Utah Supreme Court was that the legislature's reaction to Prop 4 when they basically altered substantial portions of it was not constitutionally valid. And so the question is, is this recent statute that purports to define terms to be used in the application of Prop 4, is that equally fundamentally inconsistent with Prop 4 such that it is also unconstitutional? I take it that's basically what we're looking at.
Exactly. Does it meet that constitutional standard? And that's the question again today.
And I feel like Stephen Colbert here, because I'm going to say meanwhile, as I understand it, the state GOP has initiated two signature campaigns for both something called an indirect referendum and a new citizens referendum. Let's talk about both of those. What is an indirect referendum and what are they trying to do here?
Yeah, so the indirect initiative.
Sorry, thank you.
You're completely fine. I'll talk about the referendum first, actually. So there's a referendum to recall Map C. So if the court chooses Map C, the legislature's map, and this referendum is successful, Map C will be taken away and we'll have to find another map or go through this process. It's still kind of unclear on what would happen in that scenario. The indirect initiative, now this is what we're primarily concerned about. This initiative requires around 70,400 signatures to qualify. And instead of going to the ballot for us to vote on, it will go to the legislature for them to vote on. And this indirect initiative is, it calls for the repeal of Proposition 4. And they have until November 15th to gather the signatures. And if they're successful, it will go to the legislature. And if we've learned anything from what the legislature has said about Prop 4, you know, it, they'll vote to repeal.
Okay. And so I will come back to the other initiative also. But if that were to happen, then effectively what would happen is that they would have achieved, it would have achieved indirectly what the legislature has told it couldn't do directly. So I guess the challenge to that would be, is this just another way of impeding the rights of the voters embodied in Proposition 4? Have I basically got that right?
Yes, yes. And that's another legal challenge was filed for this indirect initiative because of that very reason. Aren't they just doing the same thing they did with SB 200, just in a different way?
Now, will that one also go before Judge Gibson?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's unclear from the timeline for that, but yeah, just one court case after another right now.
And yeah, that was my question about that, is when is that ripe for adjudication? Would you have to wait to see that they actually got the signatures before a court would be willing to take that on?
It's still unclear. I mean, of course, we hope that it would be heard sooner than later, but Judge Gibson's got a really full plate right now with all these maps. Questions. And so our focus right now primarily is to make sure that they don't reach the signature threshold so we don't even have to worry about all this.
Now, the other initiative, I guess I misunderstood it. The other initiative would be, it would not be essentially trying to put before the voters a second time the issue in Prop 4. Basically, it would not be an effort to directly ask the voters to repeal Prop 4.
No, it would not. That question only would go to the legislature. The other referendum would be Map C. We would essentially approve of it or disapprove of the map. But that all hinges on whether or not the court even chooses Map C.
Yeah. Okay. That's fairly narrow.
Interesting.
Okay. And
yes.
Again, there's a signature campaign on for that as well.
Yes, and that deadline is November 17th, and they need about double the amount of signatures as an indirect initiative, so around 140,000.
Okay, and how is, okay, to help us understand how all of this morass of litigation is likely to play out in terms of time. I mean, isn't the judge under some pressure to have a decision? Don't we need to know what the maps are in some kind of timely way?
Yes, because, I mean, we're having candidate filings coming up next year. And so the Lieutenant Governor's office has set a deadline for November 10th to have a map in place, our congressional map in place, so candidates can be ready to file for those seats. And so the judge has until that date to choose a map. That being said, the indirect initiative, as well as the referendum, kind of throws a wrench in things, because what if it is successful? What if Map C is chosen and that's recalled? There's a lot of different things that could happen, and it will likely create a lot of confusion among candidates and voters, frankly.
That's a really interesting. If you had Map C recalled, somebody would have to draw a map. Who would that be, and what would it look like?
Yeah, that's we're still working through that as well, trying to figure out what that process will be. We just hope it won't come to that point.
Okay, so full day of hearings yesterday, another full day today?
Yes,
okay.
Full day today.
And then I assume we won't know anything until the judge renders a decision, which she has to do by November 10th. Is that the date?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so and last law school hypothetical, if she renders a decision that one side or the other doesn't like, can somebody sort of run in and try to appeal that as well?
Yeah, the legislature has indicated that they would appeal the decision to the Utah Supreme Court, and if necessary, the U.S. Supreme Court, if she doesn't choose a map, if she chooses a map that's not Map C.
That's interesting.
So that's what we're facing.
That's interesting. Has there been, do you know what the theory, have they expressed any theory that would get them to the U.S. Supreme Court? It would have to be a U.S. constitutional theory. And have they said what it is? Is it this notion that the U.S. Constitution talks about the role of the legislature in defining elections?
They really haven't. They've just indicated that they will appeal, and It would be a difficult question because the Supreme Court has been pretty clear on these decisions in the past.
Yeah. And mostly this is a Utah state constitutional issue. So, okay. Anything else we want to touch on before we go, Elizabeth?
No, but thank you so much for having me.
Summit County leaders may vote to impose a new sales tax next Wednesday. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports it will pay for transit and transportation initiatives ahead of the Olympics.
When a development team from Alexander Company presented updated designs for housing near Park City Heights Wednesday, planning commissioners thought they went a little too big. Park City Planning Commissioner Bill Johnson told the project managers they did not set buildings back far enough from adjacent open space. He says that effectively means the design takes up more acreage than he's comfortable with.
We purchased with our funds open space, 344 acres, and we're essentially giving you 10 acres of developable acres, but you're carving out areas and taking and encroaching on our open space that we purchased.
Commissioners John Frontero and Henry Sigg agreed. Sigg recommends cutting the amount of housing since Park City Municipal is donating the land. Alexander Company's designs also must include a stormwater retention pond, which the developer doesn't currently count as part of the 10 acres. Here's Frontero.
I do think you have almost an impossible task. The direction was fit a medium density project, 150 to 200 units in 10 acres, and build a retention pond and make it work for LIHTC. And it's a very difficult task.
The developer's latest unit mix is 34 market rate for sale units and 167 affordable rentals for area workforce. The Planning Commission will have a third meeting on the potential public-private partnership between Park City and Alexander Company November 12th. Debate over the project is unfolding under close public scrutiny. Neighbors in Park City Heights formed an opposition group last month, and some spoke out against the project again at Wednesday's meeting. Their main concerns have been traffic and impacts to the environment, as indicated by the group's name, Keep Clark Ranch Wild. As proposed, the development requires a rezone, subdividing the land, a master plan, and conditional use permit. The Park City Council has a final say on the rezone, but subdivision, the master plan, and CUP is up to the Planning Commission. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.